Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about a new subscription model at Charles Schwab, attracting talent into FinTech at the large financial institutions, London versus SF, who will win the FinTech Unicorn Contest, and a little bit of FICO inflation, how that might affect everyone. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, lots of exciting news this week, some interesting ideas, and with us is Monica.
Hi, John.
Hi, and Steve.
Good to be here again.
Glad you're here. All right, let's get started with Charles Schwab. You know, you don't see them in the news too often, which is a good thing,
I guess. It's probably a good thing, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, we're going to talk about them about also not something bad, something that they're trying different in a good way. You know, you don't go to a lawyer and they charge you some percent of what you're worth, although it might feel like it, or go to the doctor and they find out how much you make and then bill you, although it does feel like that way too. Often, you know, a large percent of what you're worth in some cases. But in financial planning and investment management, they charge a percent of your total assets under management to bill you, even though you're getting the same service as everyone else in that same fund. Well, there's been some companies that are changing that model to a straight flat fee and, in some cases, a subscription. Charles Schwab has adopted this, and although they're not the first, they're the largest one now to offer this kind of payment structure. So if you have a $250,000 account and you're paying, let's say, 0.28% to have your funds managed, that could work out to like $700 a year. Every year you're paying that. But Charles Schwab is now proposing a $300 initial fee to get set up, and then you just pay $30 a month, no matter how much money you have under management. And it's a buffet style. It's all you can eat. You can use as many of their services as much as you want for that $30 subscription.
And that includes access to their financial planners.
That's right, Monica. And you can do things like set your overall objectives, minimize your taxes, discuss college savings plans with them, managing your debt, anything that you need done is included in that fee. That's right.
And that's what I think is so interesting about this, because it's really helping Schwab differentiate itself from its traditional competitors in the investment management space and the robo-advisors who are happy to charge you, you know, in some cases, I'm sure, a flat fee, but aren't necessarily going to have a phone number for you to call and get personalized investment advice.
Some do now. I think there's a movement to go towards more a hybrid model where you have sort of the robo-advisor on your app, and then you also have the options. You can talk to a human for a fee. I think that's
$30 a month?
No, much less, I think. Much less or much more. It may be more, actually. No, I think it's more. It's based, again, on what you have in the platform, which is kind of the old model. So this is a really interesting take by Schwab, I agree.
I'm super interested to see what this looks like, and I'm very interested to see what kind of competitive pressure it puts on, you know, a more typical investment management firm. Because John did the math a little earlier, you know, you could pay, aside from your $300 intro fee, $360 a year versus $700
a year.
Could
be thousands, right?
Exactly, and that's just on $250,000 account. This is also one of the things that I liked in this article that they called out, is that this makes personalized investment advice a much more achievable thing for the non-hugely wealthy. And this is a space that has typically been served to the people who probably have the least need for it, who can weather whatever comes their way financially. They're the ones who are always getting advice thrown at them.
Right.
And people who a real quality plan might make the difference between they're making their financial goals in their life and they're not. It wasn't something that you could always find at a reasonable fee.
Yeah, one thing that occurred to me from the consumer side is the transparency. You know, you walk into a Charles Schwab or any financial planner, and maybe you don't have a lot of experience and you don't know where you're going to be paying. You don't know where the interests of that financial planner are. But with this, you just know you're paying your $30, and you can go to different Charles Schwab branches or advisors and compare even within there, and it's not going to cost you anything extra, and you don't have that fear of that you're getting guided or directed to something that's maybe better for that company, whatever it is, because you know it's just a flat fee.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, there are still fees for the investments that you jump into. So for the ETFs, there's annual expenses in the management funds, and if they're Charles Schwab, you know, they're keeping those investment funds. It can be like 0.08% to 0.19% typically for those ETFs, but that's not a huge guiding factor, I would think, you know, after the, you know, you're paying your $30.
And the article does point out that, you know, you'll have to keep some of your portfolio in cash, which is a good practice anyway. There's nothing terrible about that advice, but Schwab does pay a much lower interest rate than you might get for that same cash elsewhere. But, you know, nothing is free in life, even if it is a good deal.
Right.
Yeah, straightforward, simple, and probably getting you on the right track if you're not using any financial planner. And Charles Schwab, you know they're a large company? Guess how? Because they named this product the Schwab Intelligent Portfolios Premium Plan.
It's funny.
So if it was a fintech, it would be a one-word catchy name.
Right.
Not the Schwab Intelligent Portfolios Premium. Yeah, it would be some name.
Should we call it SIP?
SIPs.
So SIP.
SIP.
Work,
yeah.
So actually, I know that Intelligent Portfolio is their response to like their wealth funds and their personal capitals and betterments of the world.
Oh, is that the Schwab branding for
that
their...
That is the Schwab branding, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think this is part of that. I think it's just, this is bringing a more hybrid approach with a really interesting model, with a really interesting billing model, basically.
Right. So it's premium because you'll pay more, but you'll get more would with just the Intelligent Portfolio product.
Yeah. So like I said, they're not the first ones to initiate this subscription model, but they're certainly the largest. They're starting off with 35 financial planners, which I imagine they would have to expand down the line. Hopefully this turns out to be very popular and expands out to other financial planners and gets more people thinking about their long-term goals.
Mm-hmm. Always time well spent there.
Yeah, for sure,
Indeed.
One thing they mention in the article is the advice and judgment of a good financial planner can do wonders for your net worth, which we heartily agree with.
And wealthy people have known for centuries.
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely true. All right, so if you're not quite one of those wealthy people yet and you have some tech talent, I think there's some people that want to talk to you, right, Steve?
I think there are, yeah. I think there's some nice people, some nice friendly bankers in New York who would love to bend your ear about some jobs.
I like these oxymorons, like nice friendly bankers in New York.
Nice friendly investment bankers in New York, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So
technically, that's a paradox. Can only be two words to be an oxymoron.
Wow, look at us. Grammar
nice
police is in the house.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, grammar. Welcome to the Grammar Newscast. Yeah, so Goldman Sachs has created this program where they're really keying on attracting top tech talent into the bank. So now they've created this program where you can apply and you get $150,000 to basically help them research or solve a program that could be commercially oriented, is the way they phrased it, using things like machine learning or AI. They would then fund your research, and pay you a salary basically just to come into the bank, no?
The article specifically says that these are not employees, they are contractors, which actually I think is a really savvy move. Like, a lot of people might not want to be a full-time employee, but they want to try it out, they're interested in the challenge. So Goldman Sachs gets the benefit of owning whatever intellectual property they produce.
Right.
The other person, the coder or the technologist, gets some great experience and something that looks
and
good on the resume.
Name on the resume, yeah.
And to get paid, because we should all get paid for our work.
Yeah.
And Goldman also is building its brand as a tech employer or contractor of choice.
As a destination for tech talent. Although I have to wonder, given the high salaries of people who work in machine learning or AI, will they get the really top talent for this stuff? My guess is no.
You can do this as a side gig, can't you? You're
yeah,
a contractor.
I thought these were students or just recent graduates.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah. So I was thinking of it as like, oh, you know, you're a master's student and you want to do this on the side. Or maybe you are developing some of your own technology for a future startup, but you kind of want to make some money in the meantime. When you're a contractor, unless Goldman Sachs like abuses that privilege, you know, you do get to call your shots on the timing of the way that you work, and you have a lot more control over that than you would as an employee. So I actually think it makes it easier for them to recruit.
And it is still more than I make, so.
There you go.
Who's going to turn it down?
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought was really interesting in here, and it's buried way down at the bottom, because I was thinking, like, what are some of the reasons that Goldman would do this? The article clearly says that Goldman wants its technology platforms to kind of undergird the future of financial technology. So this is actually a really smart way to get a lot of people who are already in this space familiar with the existing tools that Goldman has, as well as the ones that will be built.
Go Marcus.
Pretty canny.
Yeah, and of course, you know, Goldman is very savvy, but also is MasterCard, apparently. They also have this program where they will train the, or rather enlarge, broaden, expand, I don't know what the term here is, but to get more people interested in cybersecurity. So according to some estimates, there's something like 313,000 jobs in cybersecurity. As of last year, they have been unfilled. So they have this program where it's called the Cybersecurity Talent Initiative. And they're working with, again, nonprofits, with schools, with other companies to get students to go into the field of cybersecurity to both tackle issues related to MasterCard and also Microsoft. So, again, kind of a non-traditional way to get talent into these firms by providing pretty hefty incentives as well.
Well, with all the competition, all the fintech fundings, I mean, you have to get creative, right?
You do, yeah. And one thing that I really like about this program is that this is not Goldman, where it's sort of a contract thing. This is actually an FTE job. Mm-hmm. But they also will pay you up to $75,000 of your student loans if you have any debt, which is pretty awesome, too.
The way to speak to a millennial's heart.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is one of the big benefits coming up now that people are providing is
they
some
are.
Payment plans or some way to manage your student loans better,
yeah.
If not, pay them off.
I've heard of some startups, maybe at the C level, C stage or so, that you know they offer you know the free food, the 401k, and all that stuff. But now they also will pay back part of your student loan, or at least help you cover the costs. Which would be, as a millennial, I'm guessing that would be huge.
And they'll let you sleep at your desk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, save on rent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do we have a sense of kind of where folks who participate in this program, where they're going to go? Because cybersecurity is so incredibly important. I mean, if I'm honest with myself, I feel like there must be so many more hacks and certainly hack attempts than we realize. But, like, you have really unglamorous industries like our utilities, for example, that are incredibly vulnerable to cybersecurity hacks. Is this kind of in the mix there?
I don't know about the utilities, but this will service industries like the government and also private sector. So the three companies that are in this from the private side are Microsoft, MasterCard, and Workday. But then they also are looking to get talent into the CIA and DOD and sort of the Intel space as well, the IC as they call it. So, yeah, it's mostly government and private entities. I don't know that there's any movement to broaden that into the utilities market, but I wouldn't see this applying. I wouldn't see this not applying to that.
Yeah.
So this would make sense as a source of talent for that.
All right, pay down those loans and keep us all safe, folks.
Yeah, at the same time, right.
We're counting on you, cybersecurity experts.
Speaking of job security, we're recording this in San Francisco, John, but I understand that our place sort of as the top of the heap from a tech perspective may change in the future, right?
Well, hopefully not. But so far, guess how many fintech unicorns there are based in San Francisco?
Oh, God. 17.
17.
Yeah.
Monica? I was going to say like five.
Right in between. That is nine. Which is a lot. San Francisco is not a big town, actually, right? Less than a million people, 7 by 7 miles. But there are 9 fintech unicorns, which is the highest number, actually, of any city that we know about. But London is closing in. They have had a lot of success attracting very creative and well-funded fintech startups. They have 7 fintech unicorns. And they're like I said, their funding is increasing. So they're projected to, if not surpass, at least challenge San Francisco's status as the fintech unicorn capital.
Until they all move to Paris because of Brexit.
That's the question, yeah. Will this be affected by Brexit, yeah. How old is this data?
Yeah, that's one of the limitations. Well, I mean, every place has its challenges. San Francisco is definitely under-housed, underdeveloped, and
over-homeless.
Over-homeless, for
Paris
sure.
Paris has too many French people.
Quel dommage. But they are, Paris is 3rd with 18% of overall European funding, mm-hmm. Just behind Berlin and London, which is number 1, which attracted 39% of all European fintech funding. So they're doing pretty well. They have leaders in fintech like Revolut, TransferWise, and one that I hadn't heard of before, they mention Oak North. But maybe we'll be hearing more from them because they just secured $440 million from, can only be 2 choices.
SoftBank?
SoftBank, that's right.
What's the other choice?
This is a very easy game to play. It's from SoftBank. So that's up their market cap to $2.8 billion. Or I should say their private valuation to $2.8 billion. They also have companies like Monzo and developing new ones all the time. Now, is Brexit going to break that? I don't think so. They're still close enough to the continent. They can be based in the UK, in London, and it seems to have that culture that you need to be creative and the freedom of in their economy and their regulations to promote startups and technology. And it can be based there, much like funding is based out of Silicon Valley, but the companies can be all over the place?
Yes, but typically you need your employees somewhere. And I actually think that both the US and the UK have done themselves no favors in terms of being a long-term, highly desirable place for the most talented people in the world. So you've got the UK going through whatever Brexit will be, and we don't really know how hard or soft it will be, what the immigration scheme will look like post-Brexit. And then I look at the US, and you already have started to see that, you know, you've got some very desirable would-be immigrants who are choosing Canada over the US because we have made our H-1Bs so much harder to get, and we have a pretty terrible marketing presence at the top of the house for our immigration policy right now. So I'm not going to say which of the 2 cities I think will do it. I think both cities have some really deep long-term challenges in terms of remaining like the best place to be in this part of the business.
But they still are, I think, head and shoulders above like Paris or even Berlin, which is pretty attractive from a startup point of view, right? Because they're still kind of cheaper, out of talent.
What about Beijing? What about Shanghai? I mean, do we have 10, 15 years? Yeah, probably. But, right. You know, do we have 30 years?
You gotta lay down the tracks for the future, sure.
I don't know.
Yeah. Very, very good point. So speaking of talent, I have a special talent that I haven't shared with you guys.
A superpower.
My superpower. My talent is that I have a perfect FICO score. I think you've talked about it before, but I'm going to keep harping on it. I'm so proud of it.
So first off, you have it reported in one place. Do all 3 credit reporting agencies give you the same score, Steve?
No. And I've heard that also there's a difference if you do your score on Credit Karma versus like FICO or the 3 bureaus. I'm guessing, right? Because they have a different model.
They'll calculate. Yeah.
But anyway, my score is, according to my bank, it's 850 for FICO, which is pretty excellent, right?
Bragging,
right? Yeah, that's my talent. I'm an awful braggart. But I understand.
This sounds very financial crisis. Like, you have 4 mortgages also.
I just have the one.
I mean,
once enough.
One Bay Area mortgage is enough.
One credit card, one mortgage. But apparently, I may be a victim of FICO grade inflation. What?
I mean, just like in school.
We might all be. Yeah. So Bloomberg has an article out this week around, you know, the latest thing that we all need to lose sleep over. Just kidding. Please don't. And it is that FICO scores have become quite inflated over the last few years. And that wouldn't necessarily be a terrible thing as long as lenders were also hardening their underwriting standards and their reserve amounts to account for that. But what do you know? Even though we've got seven banks testifying and front of the house today saying they're healthier than they've ever been and there won't be another financial crisis. Who knows? Any hoodle.
So what's changed in the past few years?
Well, I have to tell you that I didn't necessarily get a super clear sense of that from the article. And, you know, there's a certain amount of when you start looking at credit credit ratings, you know, you are entering somebody else's proprietary black box pretty quickly. We call it a FICO score because it's put out by the Fair Isaacs, blah, 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 blah. So we don't really know all of the things that go into it. Or I guess what I should say is we know the things that go into a FICO score. We don't necessarily know exactly what is done to them to spit out your number. But if you've ever, like, tracked your FICO score over time, you can have pretty substantial swings in it. Sometimes there's right information. Sometimes there's wrong information, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, the worry is that scores have inflated seriously since the financial crisis, but lending institutions haven't really changed the other part of their business to reflect that. Part of the reason that I was drawn to this article is we talk a lot here about how non-traditional lenders are using non-credit report information to determine who they want to lend to and at what rates. And this article talks about how the lenders who are most likely to be adversely affected by this grade inflation are those who are using FICO scores but are smaller and don't necessarily have the huge asset bases or the really gargantuan lending portfolios that their bigger competitors do.
So like a regional bank or
Exactly. Yeah. And it just made me think that we've kind of got these three. When you look at this particular viewpoint of the market, you've kind of got these three different groups. You've got your huge banks. We all know who they are. They're all testifying today. You've got your much smaller players who have not necessarily had the easiest time in the last, like, 20 years. They've had a lot of consolidation. It's been a rockier road for them. And then you've got all of the new startups who are saying, we don't even need your FICO score. We're going to take a look at your social media profile. Any way you slice it, when there is a slowdown, and there will be, and when there is a slowdown, there is often some kind of, if not a credit crunch, some kind of credit pulling back. It will be very interesting to see who still has their swim trunks on when the tide pulls out.
I love so many of those metaphors, by the way.
All of them. They're all good.
Tie two stones together to see if they'll float. And,
wait, yeah. I don't know that one.
You know, so back in the dot-com boom days, if two of your investment companies are struggling in your venture fund, you would get them to merge so that they'd be stronger. And, of course, they would fail anyway. Yes. So they would say, oh, you're trying to
think
tie
harder.
Two stones together.
Got it,
see
got
if they'll
it.
Float.
See if
they
float, yeah.
Well, maybe we'll see some stone tying together over the next few years as well.
Let's hope not. It's funny, when I was researching this, I found some sort of FICO discussion board online.
Ooh.
Pretty fast. Well, I don't know if it's fast.
What board are you going to?
I was so bored. But people post, so they have a username, and they have a question, you know, this is my score, whatever. But they also have, they give users their information, like, I have this much in credit card, this is my score. They list their mortgages, credit card balances, and all that stuff, kind of to inform.
They kind of want to reverse engineer.
Well, they just like as part of their signature in the post.
Oh.
They list all. It's like listing your D&D levels or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's like $10,000 in this
credit
card.
What other boards are you going to?
I think it's just the FICO discussion board. But it's a whole subculture that I cannot wait to dig into further because it's really fascinating. People will list, again, their mortgage, their credit card, their broker's accounts, their balances.
Maybe you can reverse engineer their ID as well.
Oh,
you must be.
You're so-and-so. You're Dungeon Master XYZ.
I want to throw some of your words back at you. You said this is something that you can't wait to research more on.
I know. Yes.
Emphasis on the moron.
I lead a very exciting life.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, There's always this narrowing of credit spreads that happens at the peak of every economic cycle, right? People aren't paying up as much because they're not perceiving all the risks that are in bond investments, in corporates. And this sounds like that for the consumer side,
right?
We're undervaluing the risk return profile. Mm-hmm. So I have seen this in corporate bonds that the risk premium is narrowing. So even though you're risky and you may have paid up like, you know, 200-300 basis points, now you're only paying up 100 basis points because the market's just desperate for return, and they're not demanding what they should be for the risk that they're getting. Mm-hmm. So we might be seeing yet another sign of the top of this economic cycle, and that's a big discussion now.
Yes,
is the signs of the mixed signals we're getting maybe just at the peak. Employment's very strong, but other things like corporate earnings are getting weaker. And those first, whatever the opposite of green shoots are, those first brown patches. Of an...
I think they're called dying roots.
Of a recession.
The dying roots. Recession.
The first dying roots.
Show your roots recession.
Yeah. So yeah, that sounds consistent with what's happening out there.
Mm. Fun times.
All right, now let's get to our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the fascinating story behind it. Steve, why don't you start us off?
Sure, I'll go first. So my number is quite depressing, and it is $30. So there's a story in the New York Times last week detailing the life of a person named Jake Orta, I think, who is an Air Force vet who lives in the Mission here in SF, and he makes approximately $30 to $40 a day by digging through the garbage of rich people's houses, including, of course, Mark Zuckerberg, who lives in a $10 million mansion three blocks away from where Jake lives. So a really stark sign of the disparity and inequality in the city, where you have a person who's a Navy veteran who may be either homeless or close to homeless, dumpster diving for sustenance and getting maybe $40 a day by selling stuff that he finds, including by going through, again, the garbage bins of Mark and Priscilla.
Two things about this article. Number one, Mark Zuckerberg is widely known to have major 24/7 security around all of his homes. And so I did think that it was interesting that this gentleman finds a way to get into the trash bins and go through them without getting hassled by security.
I think it's been ruled that your trash is the company's property.
Yes.
The second you put it out onto the curb in the bin. So
yes.
He has a constitutional... He's stealing
he's
from...
He's still breaking the law.
He's breaking the law. But he's, doing it, yeah. But he's breaking the law in terms of the garbage company, not of Mark Zuckerberg. Yeah.
Correct. But, you know, security staff can still...
They can still hassle you. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
The man can still hassle you.
And the second thing, and I don't mean to sound sanctimonious because I am sure I have thrown away things that had value and utility, but I was really shocked at what people throw away in this article. Like, have these people never heard of Goodwill or Salvation Army or your homeless shelters or your battered women shelters? Like, Jesus Christ, you know, get a bin full, get an Uber, and donate it. Like, don't throw it away. Do they even know what happens with trash? Like, if it doesn't get picked up by this guy in this article, it gets compacted and then, like, trucked out. Like,
The argument is that if you've ever lived in a college town, you know the kids will just throw anything out because they just don't give a shit.
Yeah, because they're shitty college kids.
Well,
we should hold ourselves to a higher standard.
Isn't SF at its core a city full of shitty college kids who are all grown up now?
Well, it is right? Now, but it didn't used to be.
Yeah.
Anyway, go to Goodwill, people.
Go to Goodwill.
Donate. They have a donation center. It's just right by South of Market. You can go there right after your work.
I feel like that's more common in the city to give to Goodwill. If you're out in the suburbs away from where you might not see that.
They still have Goodwill in the suburbs.
It's just not as common.
Yeah.
I never even knew that was a thing until I moved to San Francisco. And now I stop by. I drop everything off at Goodwill.
Oh, same. I have a box in my locker room that I just fill with shit.
Every 2 or 3 weeks, I'm dropping something off. But that never was part of a lifestyle or anything in the suburbs where I grew up. It was just throwing everything outside.
Yeah.
And that was it. I didn't even know there was a Goodwill. I mean, so maybe there's... Just to give those poor college kids, no matter what their trust fund size is, the benefit of the doubt that, you know, you don't know everything. So, they may not know. There might be some education that has to be done out there.
So consider yourself educated.
Now you know. No excuses.
But then I feel bad about saying that, because then the gentleman in this article, now he's deprived of his way of living because he's going through trash. He's not getting freebies from Goodwill. So, oh, God.
Very good point.
There's a lot wrong with this world, people.
No one wins. No one wins.
All right, let's stick with Facebook. My final bite is $1 billion, which is the amount that they're looking to raise from external investors into their cryptocurrency / blockchain efforts. Now, they haven't made a formal announcement. People have been tracking their job postings, so we know that at least for the last year that they've been working on something. And since trust is a big issue, everyone assumes it's going to be something blockchain related for security and for proper identification and addressing a lot of issues that Facebook has publicly had. But they're also looking for validation of their process, of their cryptocurrency, of whatever it is they're doing, from outsiders as well. So that's my number.
Won't it be a
Monica,
beautiful world?
You don't have anything, right?
Won't it be a beautiful world when we are all using one login for an end-to-end encrypted communication between Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram, and then we can use their own branded cryptocurrency to do dirty deeds? Great. I can't live. I can't wait for that world.
Yep. You want to be paid in Facebook coins?
No.
Face coins.
Face coins.
Yeah. Aren't they all face coins? They all have faces.
There are probably some coins out there that don't.
Well, yes.
Maybe not US coins.
Domestic.
Oh, yeah.
Now that I got my obligatory Facebook rant out of the way, I'm going to share my final bite, which is 64%. And that is the amount of growth that the U.S. pensions have seen in liabilities since 2007. So over the course of 12 years.
Liability? You mean so the pension
those
is
are their
borrowing?
Commitments. Those
oh,
are the
okay.
commitments, their future commitments that they have. Yeah, and sorry, we don't normally talk much about pensions here. But, you know, many old school companies and a lot of government agencies and municipalities across the nation use pensions as a retirement plan in lieu of 401ks for their employees. And pensions have been having a pretty rough go since about the 80s and the 90s when they got a little too big for their britches. And the problem here is that even though we've had a record-breaking bull market for years.
The longest in history, right?
Yes, the longest in history. Governments and companies, mainly governments actually, have continued to increase their pension obligations over this period. And so those liabilities have increased 64%, whereas even with this beautiful market, assets are only up 30%. So this is a ticking time bomb that may very well affect people you know and love. You know, if your mother or your uncle works for a government agency, they could very well see that when it comes time for them to retire, they're not going to get the number that they thought they were going to get, because what ultimately happens is cities, states, counties, and the federal government might have to say, we're going to raise taxes so high to pay these pensions that you almost kind of make that particular locality unlivable in certain ways. And that's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is people's pension promises are not going to be kept.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's like a very political thing to do, is to promise all these benefits and get elected. But there's no way to pay for them. You know, it would have to be some astronomical returns, as you pointed out, to meet those obligations, and it's not there. And you know, state and local budgets end up getting completely, and I mean completely, eaten away just by maintaining benefits for retirees.
Isn't that what happened to the city of Vallejo? Like, they had so many unfunded benefits to their public employees that the city ultimately had to
declare
bankruptcy.
Was that Stockton or Vallejo? Or
I think they both declared bankruptcy, but probably for different reasons.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm here to cheer you up.
Yeah. Well, pensions have been dying off for a long time, at least since the 401k started showing up. That didn't start to show up. It was an IRS provision in the 1970s. And everything's been switching over to invest it yourself, own it yourself. So,
yeah, I've never worked at a company that has had a pension in the past 12th.
It's never been a factor. But imagine if you're somewhere already 10 years, you're making career decisions, and then it doesn't come through. That would be that'd be horrible. That's bad investment. And kind of like investing in your own company, not diversifying, putting all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, please, even if it is
a government,
please undo that.
Things could go south. Please check with your local treasurer. All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. Please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com if you have any questions, comments, or would like to hear a certain topic discussed. And thank you for listening.
Thanks for joining.
Talk to you next week.